Hey, y'all, and welcome to Southern Fried Spooky, the podcast home of all things Southern Spooky. And this week, charred to a crisp.
Bacon.
I'm your Carolina girl, Heather, finally over the flu.
Yeah, right, and I'm your Florida man, Tony, finally over the flu.
We'd like to invite you to our digital Thanksgiving table for a little nosh, some fine sips, and some five-star reviews on your podcast platform of choice.
I am not cooking again.
Once was enough. It was great. Please find us on Facebook and leave us some comments. Find our Patreon and leave us some tips. We would be overcome with seasonal gratitude.
Indeed. We might even burst into flame.
Or song,
yeah.
As you can tell, we wrote this with the intention of releasing it before Thanksgiving, yes. But life got in the way.
So this By life, you mean influenza, but yes.
Or a really intense and clingy cold.
Yeah.
This week, one of the hot topics we're going to explore is spontaneous human combustion.
Hot topic?
Yes.
Okay.
Spontaneous human combustion refers to the death of someone from a fire originating without an apparent external source of ignition, a belief that the fire starts within the body of the victim.
Okay, so, just to start this off,
uh-huh.
A lot of people who are like, it's impossible, but let's take a scientific approach here and look at something called sphagnum. That is peat moss.
Oh, okay.
Peat moss will burst into flame for no good reason.
Okay, we will cut in here and say Tony is, while he didn't go to college, he is a bit of an autodidact, reads a lot of stuff, and he was a volunteer firefighter.
Volunteer.
So I hope you will chime in a good bit about this.
Yeah.
I can
safely say I've never seen spontaneous human combustion.
Apparently that's the thing. No one sees it happen. It just does.
Well, it's not like you're going to be walking down the road and all of a sudden, like, well, that dude's gone.
Didn't they do that once on Family Guy?
I think so.
Chronicled incidents of spontaneous human combustion, which I will say is a lot of syllables for one phrase,
Date
back to the late 15th century. Now, this idea and the term spontaneous human combustion were both first proposed in 1746 by Paul Rowley, a fellow of the Royal Society, in an article published in the Philosophical Transactions. Doesn't that sound like fabulous late night reading?
And I believe there was a famous author who actually used it to kill off one of his main characters.
Really?
Yes.
Are you going to enlighten us?
Well, go ahead and I think it may have been Dickens.
Okay. Philosophical Transactions Concerning the Mysterious Death of Countess Cornelia Zangari Bandy.
That is a name.
Yeah, I can't even tell you if that's a real name. Writing in the British Medical Journal in 1938, Coroner Gavin Thurston describes the phenomenon as having apparently attracted the attention not only of the medical profession, but of the laity 100 years ago. Referring to a fictional account published in 1834 in the Frederick Marriott Cycle.
Okay, so it was Charles Dickens in 1641 who killed off his main character, or one of his characters, in the novel Bleak House.
That sounds pretty bleak.
Yeah.
Larry E. Arnold. Thank you for looking for that.
Of course.
Arnold, a director of Parascience International, wrote in his 1995 book, Ablaze! Exclamation point at the end.
Oh, wow. And it's in italics. So, ablaze.
Well, the italics was just what I did. It probably should be underlined.
Oh, okay.
But the exclamation point is definitely exciting.
So, from now on, you have to say, ablaze.
With the hand gesture.
Yes, yes.
That there had been about 200 cited reports of spontaneous human combustion worldwide over a period of about 300 years. I just realized this is what happens to us when we've spent a week on NyQuil.
Oh, right.
As if we needed the help. Now, if you want the science or the pseudoscience behind it.
That's pseudo. No, you don't. It's like pneumonia. You don't pronounce the P.
You didn't have to call me out on that.
Just at you next time.
You can do the research. I started to do that and realized it gets pretty deep pretty fast, and I'm not entirely sure that's what our audience wants.
Well, let's just call it to, yes, it happens. It has something to do with Wick theory, avoid alcohol.
I was going to say, there are theories that involve alcoholism, though that could be kind of a puritanistic sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or a theoretical particle called the pyrotron, which I really kind of like that idea. You'll see phrases like wick effect batted around, or even self-immolation, which interestingly accounts for 1% of suicides in the West, but 40% in the East. Or even ball lightning and thermite bombs were considered.
Yes, I mean, you know, it happens when people are just sitting at their house and they get depressed and they're just like, you know, thermite bomb. I've seen firsthand what happens when thermite goes through a car engine block.
Was this in real life or a training?
No. This was real life. Don't ask questions. Let's just say, don't ask questions.
I will have lots of questions when we stop recording.
Yes, but it's not thermite. Thermite will burn through sheer steel.
Interesting. So we'll skip on over all of that. To the examples of SHC. Okay, that is not any easier.
No.
A fairly well-known one. I first recall reading about this in my dad's Reader's Digest book, Strange Stories, Amazing Facts. I don't
remember those.
I love this book, and this is one of the ones that got me started on the idea of we should do a podcast about creepy stuff.
Yeah.
All right. The name, Mary Reeser. I chose her mainly because she's well-documented, and she's in our territory, so to speak.
Yeah.
She was a resident of St. Petersburg, Florida.
Uh-huh, been there.
Well, I figured you weren't in Russia. And it was one of the first cases of potential spontaneous human combustion to be investigated by national law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Mary Reeser started out as Mary Hardy from Columbia, Pennsylvania. So, okay, she's not from the South, but she was living there. Born in 1884.
She's Southern by proxy.
Sure, why not? She's one of those many people who retires to Florida.
Yeah.
It happened for so long. Okay, your opinion. Is Florida really a dislocated part of the North?
Yeah, yeah, you know, like, there are more Yankees in Florida than there are Southerners. I'm not joking.
Does it depend on the time of year?
Yeah, it really does.
In July of 1951, Mary Reeser mysteriously burned into a pile of ashes in her Florida home.
Left nothing but her feet.
Yeah, the apartment around her suffered almost no damage, leading to theories that she spontaneously combusted. She ended up becoming famous as the Cinder Lady in newspaper accounts of the day. So at roughly 8 a.m. on July 2nd, 1951, her landlady, Pansy Carpenter, arrived at Reeser's apartment on Cherry Street with a telegram. Ms. Carpenter tried the door and found the metal doorknob to be uncomfortably warm to the touch. So she called the authorities. Reeser's remains, that were largely ashes, and maybe large ashes, I don't know, were found among the remnants of the chair in which she had been sitting. All that remained of Reeser was part of her left foot, daintily wearing a slipper, allegedly her spine, and her skull. Plastic household objects at a distance from the seat of the fire were softened and had melted a little bit. Reeser's skull had survived and was found among the ashes, but shrunken to the size of a teacup. However, this description was disputed by a fire researcher who was in Bradenton for a conference at the time and managed to view the scene. Do you have opinions on that as a fire professional or a former fire professional?
Not really. I've never seen it. I don't know.
Okay. I guess maybe you don't know that kind of depth of firefighting.
I've read the case study. Like, I've read about this.
Okay.
I've seen pictures. Seen the pictures of this.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have seen the picture of that one slippered foot just sort of by itself.
Yeah. And the only thing behind the science, you have lost a loved one. You have dealt with cremation.
Yeah.
You know how hot it gets to burn a body completely. How hot it has to be.
I don't remember, but I'm sure. I mentioned this later on, so we'll get there.
Okay. But what I'm saying is, for it to reach that kind of temperature in a room with minimal damage is very confusing.
Yeah, that's kind of the point of this one. It's just weird. The chair she'd been sitting in at the time of her death, it burned.
Yeah.
But aside from a bit of soot and a few melted light switches, famously plastic, the rest of her house was essentially untouched.
I bet you the smell was horrible.
Maybe. It was confusing and confounding to the police. Several hours of steady temperatures over 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit are required for a body to be cremated. Okay, you just mentioned that.
Yeah.
So how had she burned at a high enough temperature to be cremated without destroying the surrounding apartment, let alone the entire building?
The entire building, like, yeah.
I think we've also mentioned that, like, newspapers were nearby. Newspapers will light if you look at them hard.
Oh, yeah. If you fart hard, the newspaper will catch on fire.
On July 7th, 1951, St. Petersburg Police Chief J.R. Reichert sent a box of evidence from the scene to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. He included glass fragments found in the ashes, 6 small objects thought to be teeth, a section of the carpet, and the surviving shoe. Reichert included a note saying, "We request any information or theories that could explain how a human body could be so destroyed, and the fire confined to such a small area, and so little damage done to the structure of the building and the furniture in the room, not even scorched or damaged by smoke."
Now, I'm not, you know me, I'm not an academic, but I do like working on small theories.
You do.
And one of my theories has to do with mitochondria and how that's the powerhouse of your body. Your mitochondria produce the electricity that runs your body.
I didn't realize it was electrical, but I know we all grow up, we go to classes learning mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell.
Well, I mean, yeah, but what I'm saying is, you know me, I can't wear metal because my body produces enough electricity.
True.
So what happens when your mitochondria go completely freaking haywire and cause your entire body to burst into flame?
Maybe that's where the pyrotron comes from.
Yeah, maybe.
So the FBI eventually declared that Reeser had been incinerated by the wick effect.
Yep.
Which I suppose most people are familiar with, but essentially...
not John Wick, by the way.
Totally different effect. This was before John Wick, I assume.
Yes.
She was a known user of sleeping pills. I mean, it was the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And a heavy smoker.
Mm-hmm.
So they hypothesized that she had fallen asleep and unconscious while smoking and set fire to her what I presume to be nylon night clothes.
Right.
Once the body starts to burn, the FBI wrote in the report, "There is enough fat, I'm sorry, Mrs. Reeser, and other flammable substances to permit varying amounts of destruction to take place."
Do you know what tallow is?
I do.
Okay, so yeah, they used to make oils and fats to burn out of something called tallow.
Wasn't that from whales?
Which is made from animals, yes.
Well, animal fat.
Animal fat.
Before we had nice refined paraffin wax to make candles.
We had something called tallow made of animal fat.
I've heard it smells not great.
It does not smell good.
It is not a Yankee candle,
no. No, it smells greasy.
Yeah. Ew. Yeah. Sometimes.
Like, have you ever been in a house that, like, grease has caught on fire?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the smell of tallow.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Sometimes, this destruction by burning will proceed to a degree which results in almost complete combustion of the body. When interviewed by a local paper, Reeser's daughter-in-law, Ernestine Reeser, said the cigarette dropped to her lap. Her fat, I'm sorry, Mrs. Reeser, was the fuel that kept her burning. The floor was cement, and the chair was by itself. There was nothing around her to burn. It's an apartment. There has to be something around her. According to Mary Reeser's son, Dr. Richard Reeser Jr., who had visited her just hours before her death.
Yeah.
His mother had planned to change into her nightgown, which she had, take 2 sleeping pills, which she did,
yeah,
and smoke a cigarette before bed, which she was in the process of doing, yeah, I guess. Dr. Wilton M. Krogman, a physical anthropologist from the University of Pennsylvania, was a consultant on Reeser's case. He said at the time, "I cannot conceive of such complete cremation without more burning in the apartment." The fact that only Reeser, her chair, and the rug beneath it burned in the blaze bewildered Krogman, even after the FBI report was released. "I regard it as the most amazing thing I have seen," Krogman said. "As I review it, the short hairs on my neck bristle with vague fear. Were I living in the Middle Ages, I'd mutter something about black magic."
Okay, and here's another thing.
Hmm.
I don't know of a sleep med on the market that you can get over the counter.
In the 50s?
In the 50s. Now, unless she was using laudanum.
I don't know if that was still popular in the 50s.
But what I'm saying is, if you burst into flame, even from a completely passed out state, you're going to rouse.
One would hope so, because that kind of is painful.
Unless you're in a coma?
Yeah. That is the other thing. How did she... Did she not notice? Did she notice and just went up quickly? It's just one of those things of, there's so many questions. And even with good scientific explanations, we still have the, but what... How did she burn but not her apartment? Yeah. What happened? Maybe it was aliens and they just zapped the crap out of her.
Right?
I don't know. Mac. The cats are giving you such a look.
We come in peace. We come in peace.
Shoot to kill. Mrs. Reeser was buried in the Chestnut Hill Cemetery outside Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Now, that was a very short story, and I was tired of doing short stories, so yeah. I looked up a second story that was also about family and warm feelings, holiday stuff.
Baby, I have butterflies in my stomach for you. Wait. Those are fireflies. Holy crap!
So, I included a second tale. Now, this one probably could have been a standalone episode, but we haven't done a long one for you guys in so long.
Yeah.
So, we're going to cover... Our next tale is also fire-related, but is more of a disappearance, which I know you're fond of.
Yeah.
The tragic story of the Sauter family.
Like, the whole family.
Half of them.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with this?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
This is one of the stories that I researched during, when I was doing the comic book work.
Oh, okay. So, and we could have almost waited on this one a little bit, because it takes place on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. So we're a little ahead of ourselves, but not much.
Deck the halls with boughs of... Wait, where are they?
On Christmas Eve, 1945, a fire destroyed the Sauter residence in Fayetteville, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. At the time, George Sauter, his wife Jenny, and 9 of their 10 children lived in the home. 10 children. During the fire...
This had to be a big house.
I would hope so. Or they have, like, 3-level bunk beds or something. Right. During the fire, George, Jenny, and 4 of the 9 children escaped. The bodies of the other 5 children have never been found. And it seems they believed the 5 were dead initially, but this idea changed over the years. In the 1950s, you know, when Mrs. Reeser was having a warm time.
Yeah.
The family put up a billboard at the site along State Road 16 with pictures of the 5, offering a reward for information that would bring closure to the case. And it remained standing until shortly after Jenny Sauter passed away in 1989. So we'll start at the beginning.
Damn near 30 years.
Right? As far as I can tell, none of them have ever been found. George Sauter was born Giorgio Sardiu in Tula, Sardinia, Italy, in 1895. He immigrated to the U.S. when he was 13, and for the rest of his life, George, as he became known, would not really talk a lot about why he had left his homeland specifically, but he was known to share some opinions about the Italian government. Sauter eventually found work on the railroads in Pennsylvania, and after a few years, he took more permanent work as a driver in Smithers, West Virginia. He then started his own trucking company, initially hauling fill dirt to construction sites and later hauling coal mined in the region. George Sauter married Jenny Cipriani, a storekeeper's daughter in Smithers who had also immigrated from Italy in her childhood. Ooh, you can imagine the arguments.
I was about to say, seems like a 1950s thing to do.
I guess. The Sauters settled outside nearby Fayetteville, which had a large...
Whenever you say Fayetteville, I think North Carolina.
I know, right? Well, you know, we in the South, we pretty much like to have recognizable town names, so every state has a collection of the same names.
Yep.
Lexington, Lancaster. This Fayetteville had a large population of Italian immigrants. They settled in a 2-story timber frame house 2 miles north of the town proper. In 1923, they had their first child.
And then they continued. Bro, get off her.
Dude. George's business prospered, and they became one of the most respected middle-class families around, in the words of one local official. However, George had some strong opinions. You don't know what that's like.
Oh, no, not at all.
And was not shy about expressing them, sometimes alienating people. In particular, his strident opposition to Italian dictator Benito Mussolini...
I was about to say Mussolini in the 50s.
...had led to some strong arguments within the immigrant community. The last of the Sauter children was born in 1942. By then, their second oldest son, Joe, 21, had left home to serve in the military during World War II. The following year, Mussolini was deposed and executed. That has nothing to do with the house fire, just background.
Or so we think.
However, okay, well, yeah, not directly, but apparently it is related. George's criticism of the late dictator had left some hard feelings. In October 1945, a visiting life insurance salesman warned George that his house would go up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed, attributing this all to the dirty remarks you have been making about Mussolini. Nice house, we'd hate to see something happen to it.
Right?
Another visitor to the house, ostensibly seeking work.
Buonasera! Buonasera!
Took the occasion to go around to the back and warn George that a pair of fuse boxes would cause a fire someday. Which was puzzling because he had just had the house rewired with the installation of an electric stove, and the local electric company said it was perfectly safe. In the weeks before Christmas that year, George's older sons had noticed a strange car parked along the main highway through town, its occupants watching the younger solder children as they returned from school. Nothing like peculiar happenings to stoke a little paranoia.
Right.
The Sauter family celebrated on Christmas Eve, 1945. The phone rang at 12:30 a.m. Ginny woke up and, okay, young people, they only had one phone and it was downstairs. So she woke up and went downstairs to answer it. The caller was a woman whose voice she did not recognize, asked for a name she was not familiar with. She was calling from a party, it sounds like.
Hi, we're calling about your car's extended warranty.
Sounds of laughter and clinking glasses in the background. Jenny sleepily told her, "You have reached the wrong number." And later on, the caller was identified and confirmed it was just a wrong number. I would have to kill this one. 12:30. Ugh. So she hung up and returned to bed. And as she did so, she noticed that the lights were still on. I assume they mean the Christmas lights, but yeah. I could be wrong. And the curtains were not drawn. Two things the children normally attended to when they stayed up later than their parents. So, like any weary mother, she closed the curtains, turned out the lights, and went back to bed. At 1 a.m., she hadn't been asleep very long.
No.
She was awakened again by the sound of an object hitting the house's roof with a loud bang, then a rolling noise.
And then arose such a clatter. She rose to her feet to see what was the matter.
I think I might have gotten up, but I don't know. Maybe she just figured there wasn't anything she could do about that. So after another half hour, so now we're at 1:30, she woke up again smelling smoke. When she got up...
Yes, George, I thought you quit.
She found that the room George used as his office was on fire, all around the telephone line and the fuse box. Both parents and four of their children, Marion, 19, Sylvia, 2, John, 22... and George Jr., 16, they got out. They frantically yelled to the children upstairs, apparently in the attic, but heard no response. They couldn't go up, as the stairs were already aflame. Ablaze.
There we go, see? Yep, you remembered.
Efforts to contact emergency services to rescue the children were oddly complicated. The phone didn't work, in this house, obviously, so Marion ran to the neighbor's house to call the Fayetteville Fire Department. A driver on the nearby road had also seen the flames and called from a nearby tavern. Either the neighbor or the passing motorist was eventually successful in reaching the fire department from another phone in the center of town. George attempted to climb the house's outside wall and broke open a window, and cut his arm in the process. He intended to use a ladder to get to the attic to rescue the other children, but the ladder was not in its usual spot next to the house. Could not be found. A water barrel that could have been used to extinguish the fire was frozen solid. I guess you could still use it, it would just take a while.
Yeah.
George then tried to pull both of his trucks he used in his business up to the house and to climb onto them to climb to the attic window, but neither of them would start, despite having worked perfectly the previous day. Frustrated, the six sodders who had escaped had no choice but to watch the house burn down and collapse slowly over the next 45 minutes. They assumed the other children had perished in the blaze. The fire department, low on manpower due to the war, and relying on individual firefighters to call each other in a phone tree, did not respond until later that morning. Chief F.J. Morris said the next day that the already slow response was further hampered by his inability to drive the fire truck, requiring that he wait till someone who could drive was available.
Wow.
Why would a fire chief not be able to drive the truck?
Maybe he was injured.
Maybe. Keep in mind,
they didn't have power steering or anything back then. Like, brakes required a lot of force. So we're talking like driving back then was a chore.
Okay. They just don't explain why he couldn't drive. Yeah. I don't understand it, but okay. The firefighters could do little but look on, so like, hey, look, there's a fire. And sift through the ashes that were left in the Sodders' basement. By 10 a.m., Morris, the fire chief, told the Sodders that they had not found any bones, as might have been expected if the other children had been in the house as it burned. According to a different account, they did find a few bone fragments, but chose not to tell the family. It has also been noted by modern fire professionals that their search was cursory at best. Nevertheless, Morris believed that the five children unaccounted for had died in the fire, suggesting it had been hot enough to burn their bodies completely. Morris told George to leave the site undisturbed so that the state fire marshal could conduct a more thorough investigation.
Yeah.
However, after 4 days, George and his wife could not bear the site anymore, so he bulldozed 5 feet of dirt over the site with the intention of converting it to a memorial garden for the lost children. Now, I know people grieve in weird ways, but it seems to me like you're not doing yourself any favors with
that. Yeah.
The local coroner convened an inquest the next day, which held that the fire was an accident caused by faulty wiring.
I'm fairly sure everyone could hear your air quotes.
Amongst the jurors was the man who had threatened George that his house would be burned down and his children destroyed in retribution for his anti-Mussolini remarks.
See? Mussolini.
How convenient. Death certificates for the five children were issued December 30th. George and Jenny were too grief-stricken to attend the funeral on January 2nd, although their surviving children did go. Not long after, the Sodder family started to question all the official findings about the fire.
Well, yeah, wouldn't you?
Totally. They wondered why, if it had been caused by an electrical problem, the family's Christmas lights had remained on through the fire's early stages. Didn't she turn them off? When the power should have gone out. Then they found the missing ladder at the bottom of a ditch 75 feet away. A telephone repairman told the Sodders that the phone's line had not been burned, but cut by someone who had been willing and able to climb 14 feet up the pole to reach 2 feet out away from it to do so.
They probably used that ladder.
Maybe. Jenny also had trouble accepting Morris's belief that all traces of the children's bodies had been burned completely by the fire. You may have opinions on this. I would not really know. Many of the household appliances had been found, still recognizable in the ash, along with fragments of the tin roof. She got very obsessed. Yeah. She contrasted the results of the fire with a newspaper account of a similar house fire that she read around the same time that killed a family of seven, and skeletal remains of all the victims were reported to have been found.
Yeah.
She contacted a local crematorium and asked about the fire, like, how much does it take to burn a body?
1,500 degrees.
They told her that human bones remain even after bodies are burned at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 hours, far longer and hotter than the house fire had been.
And then they have to crush those bones up.
Yes, that's a cremulator.
Yeah.
The Sodder's truck failure to start was also considered. Now, George believed that they'd been tampered with. However, one of George's sons-in-law told the Charleston Gazette Mail and
Sons-in-law or son-in-laws?
I think it's sons-in-law.
Okay.
In 2013, that he thought, just in everyone's panic and haste, that he probably just flooded the engine. Would you care to explain that to people who don't drive
old fashioned in the 50s? Yeah. well, most trucks back then, you would turn and you would pump the gas to get the engine to cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you pumped it too much, it would spit enough to stop the spark from happening. So therefore, they call that a flood.
Unlike today, where you can all but press a button on most cars. Well, yeah. Some cars. Anyway, I knew it was a thing. I just didn't know exactly what it was.
Yeah.
Thank you. Evidence soon emerged that the fire was instead set deliberately. The driver of a bus that passed through Fayetteville late Christmas Eve said he had seen some people throwing balls of fire at the house. A few months later, Sylvia found a small, hard, dark green rubber ball-like object in the brush nearby. George said it looked like a pineapple bomb.
That's a grenade.
A hand grenade, or some other incendiary device used in combat.
They kind of look like pineapples with a metal, like a metal pole sticking out of it.
Okay.
And on the top, you pull this little pin and then kind of chuck it like a hammer.
Oh, okay. Witnesses claim to have also seen the missing Sauter children themselves. One woman who had been watching the fire from the road said she had seen some of them peering out of a passing car while the house was burning. Another woman at a rest stop between Fayetteville and Charleston, Virginia, or West Virginia.
I was about to say, Fayetteville, Virginia, Charleston, South Carolina.
No.
That's like 700 miles.
Yeah, not here. The other Charleston. Said she had served them breakfast the next morning and noted the presence of a car with Florida license plates in the rest stop's parking lot as well. She tried to talk to the adults with them, and they just basically ignored her, so
yeah.
She did not pursue that. The Sauters hired a private investigator named C.C. Tinsley to look into the case. Tinsley informed the family that the insurance salesman who had threatened George over the anti-Mussolini statements had been on the coroner's jury that ruled the fire an accident, which we knew, but he didn't know.
Unbeknownst to him, but announced to us.
Announced to us.
Yes.
On one occasion, George saw a magazine photo of a group of young ballet dancers in New York City, and one of them looked like his missing daughter, Betty. He drove all the way to the girls' school and demanded repeatedly to see the girl himself. For some peculiar reason, he was refused.
Gee, I wonder why.
I mean, I feel bad for him, but he probably sounded like a lunatic.
I need to see this little girl! I need to see this little girl! Okay, sir, you're about to get shot.
Please go, sir. George also tried to interest the FBI in investigating what he considered a kidnapping. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, again,
J. Edgar Hoover,
personally responded to his letters, "Although I would like to be of service, the matter related appears to be of the local character and does not come within the investigative jurisdiction of this bureau. If the local authorities requested the bureau's assistance," he added, "he would of course direct agents to assist, but the Fayetteville police and fire departments declined to do so."
Glad to help out a fan. Hugs and kisses, J. Eddie.
In August 1949, George was able to persuade Oscar Hunter, a Washington, D.C. pathologist, to supervise a new search through the dirt at the house site. Now, after a very thorough search, artifacts including a dictionary that had belonged to the children and some coins were found. How do you just miss a dictionary? Anyway.
There's been one sitting in the back of my Jeep for months now, and we keep forgetting about it.
But it's 5 inches thick. A bone was found, but was determined to have been in the dirt brought in, not from the fire. I didn't put it in the script, but he mentioned he got the pile of dirt from the local cemetery. How freaking weird is that? They just mentioned it very casually.
Oh, by the way, dirt from a graveyard. So, would you consider that consecrated ground?
I don't know. Maybe it was a pile waiting to be used.
Maybe.
I couldn't say. I just found it waiting there.
Well, we were going to bury Grandma, but someone stole the dirt.
We'll just use little shovels and beach buckets. The investigation and its findings attracted national attention, and the West Virginia legislature held 2 hearings on the case in 1950.
All in favor of this guy's a wacko, say aye.
Aye.
Case dismissed.
Afterwards, however, Governor Oki L. Pattison.
Whoa, what a name.
I hope that's not his given name. And State Police Superintendent W.E. Burchett, I'm not sure, told the Sauters the case was hopeless and closed it at the state level. The FBI decided it had jurisdiction as a possible interstate kidnapping, but dropped the case after 2 years of following fruitless leads. With the end of official efforts to resolve the case, the Sauter family did not give up hope. They had flyers printed up with the pictures of the children, offering a $5,000 reward, which was then doubled to $10,000, for information that would have settled the case for even one of them.
Yeah.
In 1952, they put up a billboard at the side of the house and another along U.S. Route 60 near Anstead with the same information. It would in time become a landmark for traffic through Fayetteville on U.S. Route 19, today 16.
Oh.
One day, Jenny found in the mail a letter addressed to her. How convenient she found it. Postmarked in Central City, Kentucky, but with no return address. And inside was a picture of a young man, around 30, with features strongly resembling Lewis's, who would have been in his 30s if he had survived. And on the back was written, Lewis Sauter, I love brother Frankie. Just kind of mysterious.
Wow.
George admitted to the Charleston Gazette Mail late the next year that the lack of information had been like hitting a rock wall. We can't go any further. He nevertheless vowed to continue. Time is running out for us, he admitted in another interview around that time. But we only want to know. If they did die in the fire, we want to be convinced. Otherwise, we want to know what happened to them.
I mean, who wouldn't, right?
Though I suppose that was probably with a slight Italian accent.
Yeah.
George Sauter died in 1969, and Jenny and her surviving children continued to seek answers to their questions about the missing children's fate. John was the exception. He never talked about the night of the fire except to say that the family should just accept what happened and move on with their lives. After George's death, Jenny stayed in the family home, and for the rest of her life, she wore black in mourning and tended the garden at the site of the former house.
Good Lord.
It just sounds like if you move, I mean, losing a child is hard. Losing five must have been beyond devastating. So, I mean, I can't really blame her, but it is difficult. And after her death in 1989, the family finally took down the billboard. Stacey Horn did a segment on the case for National Public Radio, yay NPR, around its 60th anniversary in 2005. She believes the children's deaths in the fire is the most plausible solution in a contemporaneous post on her blog with material she had cut from her story for Time. She noted that the fire had continued to smolder all night after the house collapsed, and that 2 hours was not enough time to search the ash thoroughly. Even if it had been, the firefighters might not have known what to look for, though I kind of feel like most firefighters would, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I don't know about the way they did shit in the 50s.
Fair enough. However, she said, there is enough genuine weirdness about this whole thing.
Yeah.
That if someday it is learned that the children didn't die in the fire, I won't be shocked. So, Stacey Horn and Mr. Krogman are both like, we don't know, it's just weird.
There's a lot of things weird about this case.
Well, other than the ones I've listed, what is anything stand out for you?
You can't chalk it up to a series of unfortunate events.
Hello, hello, hello.
Well, what I'm saying is, like,
it's... Volunteer Fire Department, VFD. Right?
But what I'm saying is, everything happening all at once is way too much to be coincidence.
Right. I agree.
Like, if he tried to get out and the truck didn't work, then you're just like... Yeah, that you know, it's something happened. It's bad. But when you have things that are vital to help him get out and everything he looked for was missing, tampered with, and or not working, that's when any fire investigator of sound mind and body would go, this is sus.
That's the official language as well. Let alone the weird things that, I mean, maybe it's not weird then, but to us nowadays, like the idea that each individual fire department volunteer had to call the next one, and it took them, like, hours
again,
to get
the
there.
Again, the 50s, they didn't have paging systems and stuff like that back then.
True, but I'm surprised they wouldn't have anybody just on hand, wouldn't they?
Well, they do. It's a switchboard.
Well, I mean, like, staying in the firehouse. Or is that just a myth?
No, that's just especially smaller towns like that, their volunteer fire department, probably wasn't manned, except for by one person. That's who they contacted, and then he had to trickle down the information. So
that plus all the difficulties at the Sauter house, it was just a magnificent mess.
Like I said, a series of unfortunate events. It's like every star aligned.
It was, we might say, a hot mess.
Yes.
In 2022...
A cluster flub.
The History Channel aired an episode of its series, History's Greatest Mysteries, that detailed the events of the case, and now I have to look that up and watch it. So, there you have it. An episode full of overcooked or absent relatives.
Wow.
very in the spirit for the holidays.
Right.
We hope you've enjoyed it, you sickos.
Yes, please turn off your Christmas trees before you go to bed.
And check the ovens.
Yes.
Because I guess it's late, too late.
Because you just might have a gremlin in there.
Now I'm hearing that music. Thank you so much. Please feel free to comment on our Facebook page and check out our Patreon. And, you know, we'd be grateful for the 5-star reviews Indeed. Left on the podcast platform of your choice. Thank you for your patience while we are out sick.
Yes, yes. We hope you accept the doctor's note because, you know, the rest of the teachers, they don't like us anyway.
We even missed the last weekend, the closing weekend of fair.
Yeah, we were both laid up that weekend. It was bad.
It was very sad.
Yeah.
And thanks to those of you who did come out to the festival and actually said hello and recognized us. There's at least one guy. He had a pen named that where he was labeled as a NPC.
Yep, yep.
I wish I knew your name, but thanks for saying hello.
Hit us up on Facebook.
So, y'all, join us next time when we get up to some more spooky holiday shenanigans.
Indeed.
And it is starting to get a little chilly. Okay, by our standards, it's like, what, 56 today?
Yeah.
So keep warm, but not that warm.
Yeah, yeah. In the meantime, spontaneous combusting.
And be careful with your turkeys and the hot oil, though I guess we don't have to worry about that till Christmas if people do Christmas turkeys. In the meantime, I'm your Carolina girl, Heather.
And I'm your Florida man, Tony.
We are Southern Fried Spooky.
Wait. Now our stories are fried.
Yay!
Yeah, sorry.
I feel like we should almost say, and this episode was sponsored by NyQuil.
Right?
It wasn't, but it might as well have been.
Brought to you by NyQuil.
We have been brought to you by NyQuil.
Exactly.
Or DayQuil.
Keep in mind, not sponsored by NyQuil, actually.
But we'll keep our options open. Until next week.
Bye, y'all.
I really can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
No, I'm serious. It's cold outside.
This evening has been...
No, like, it's cold, like frost.
So very nice.
No, like, it's... The doorknob is frozen.
My mother will start to worry.
I'm fairly sure she doesn't want you to freeze to death.
And father will be pacing the floor.
He died 2 years ago.
So really, I'd better scurry.
Your tauntaun will freeze before it reaches the first marker.
Maybe just half a drink more.
And then I guess he'll see me in hell. It's 50 degrees in the south. Everyone's dying.